Welcome to the Entrepreneur Podcast. If you're growing a brand around your nerdy passion, you can learn from business and marketing podcasts, or you can learn from nerds like you. This is the show built by bloggers, cosplayers, gamers, artists, and other entrepreneurs that are making the things you love. How's it going, entrepreneurs? Welcome to episode 64 of the Entrepreneur Podcast by Under the Capes. I'm your host, Tim, and I've got a great episode for you this week and a lot of great stuff going on in my entrepreneur journey. PAX East is next weekend and I'm really looking forward to it. Last year was my very first PAX East and I had a great time there. I'm doing a lot more there this year. And if you're heading there, it'd be awesome to see you there. I will be doing a panel. I ran a panel at Fan Expo Boston, but this is the first time I'll ever be a guest on a panel, which I'm really excited for. It's Renegade versus Paragon: Morality Lessons from a Horrible Goose. 6:30 on Thursday in the Cuttlefish Theater. And this is being run by Robin Bates from Coaching for Geeks, who I had on episode 62 of the podcast. And it's going to be a really fun panel where we talk about classic gaming moral dilemmas and the decisions of whether to be good or evil in a gaming setting, I'm going to be part of the panel of people kind of debating this topic and hopefully convincing or swaying some of the people on in the audience. And it seems like it's going to be an awesome panel. I'm going to be up there with Anya Combs from Kickstarter, Kyle Stephen Porter from the PAX Diversity Lounge and Geeks Out, and Victoria Tran from Kit Fox Games. So I'm really looking forward to that. Definitely, if you're coming to PAX East, check it out on Thursday. And I will also be going back to volunteering again with the Roll Initiative, who I had on the podcast back in episode 58. They run all the Dungeons & Dragons Adventurers League games at PAX East, and they're going to be running them all weekend long from, like, I think 10:30 a.m. until midnight, probably. And I will be running games Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. Pretty consistently. Most mornings at 10:30 a.m. And then for a good portion of the day, I'll be running two sessions a day. So you can check out that, and I'm really looking forward to that as well. We're going to be doing some Acquisitions Incorporated Adventures League content, which I've never done a game in the Acquisitions Incorporated world, and using that source material. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Really great for anybody who's never played D&D before, or some low level adventures that you want to check it out and get in with some new people. So that's a lot of fun. Definitely stop by that. And otherwise, I'll just kind of be wandering around the convention, checking out some new games, and looking forward to it. So if you're there, let me know, and hopefully see you there. I have an awesome guest for you this week who I actually met at a convention last year. George Vega, who is an awesome comic book artist, who I met at Fan Expo Boston last year and loved his artwork, and then got to see again at New York Comic Con, got a couple more pieces of his art there. He's got a great style, and he just recently, at the end of last year, his Kickstarter for his independent comic, The World of M, was fully funded, and he's just started. He's fulfilled his Kickstarter orders, and he's accepting now orders for new comics for issue 1, working on issue 2. It is a steampunk fantasy adventure story set in a world where machines, magic, and mayhem are the order of the day. And it follows Jack Mast, a man that must unburden himself from his past and find friendship with a sentient steambot called Walter Tank. And the first issue is really cool, and it's a very intricate and fleshed out world that's my kind of favorite kind of stories of any kind. So I'm really loving it so far. You can actually check out the first 9 pages of the first issue at theworldofm.net. And that's something we talk about a little bit in the episode, is how is part of the success of his Kickstarter was offering content up front, and you know, a lot of art up front, and he did a fantastic job marketing this Kickstarter and now marketing the completed issue 1. And we go into a lot of that stuff, from how he started his comic book career to you know, working on various projects, working conventions, working through Kickstarter. So this is a great conversation for comic book creators of any kind, or really any independent creator or anyone on their entrepreneur journey. So let's dive right in. All right, so I'm now joined by George Vega. George, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so can you tell me a little bit about how you got started as an artist?
Oh, yeah, how I got started. Well, I probably my story's probably very typical of most artists. We all start drawing when we're young, very young, and it kind of sticks, and you become pretty obsessed with it, and you keep drawing and drawing some more. You know, first you're better than that guy or girl in your class. Then you're better than everybody in your class. Then you're better than everyone in your grammar school. Then you're better than everyone in your high school. And then you go to college, and then you're not really the best guy anymore or the best girl anymore. Then you're just kind of somewhere in the middle, or you know, or some people are so super talented, they're way up there. And then you got to fight your way back up to the top again. And then you become a professional, and then you start at the bottom again. So I think that's an abridged version of you know, what happens or can happen if you go to, you know, if you go through the college route or what have you with your education. But that's basically you know, the breakdown of that. But I always do have a story I impart as far as what made me curious with drawing and really just wanting to draw anything at all was the Voltron TV show. Back in the 80s, when that aired, and you know, I thought it was, you know, it looked so awesome. You know, I wanted to, and then, you know, I had a pencil and crayons, and I wanted to draw it. And I remember asking my parents, you know, how do they do this? You know, how is this made? And my mother explaining to me that it's drawn by hand, and it's called, you know, it's called animation, and you know, every single second is drawn, and you know, and that's how they make cartoons. And I was like, wow, that's awesome. And then I remember waiting for the credits to roll and trying to see a name, because since I assumed that the whole world basically lived on our block or something, because I was going to try to look for a name and say, hey, mom, that guy there, he draws. Why don't you take me to his house so he can show me how to draw? And little did I know about, you know, animation and the fact that it was drawn in Japan. So that wasn't going to happen. But that was my first fascination and my first memory of wanting to draw.
And kind of realization that it was a job that people did?
Yeah.
And yeah, when did you make the, when did you start becoming a professional artist? You said you went to school for art?
Yeah. But that really didn't... The story itself is a really long story, and I actually went to FIT in New York, and I majored in illustration, and that was critical to my development as far as figure drawing, as far as reaching a certain level. And I really didn't want to stay there for the, you know, it's a FIT, I guess, like most art colleges, when you first go, you have to declare your major right away. Because as soon as you start your first semester, it's very intensive. You're already committed to a 6-hour drawing weeks or 6-hour drawing from the live model, or that's the way it was back then. So you draw from the model those 6 hours. So that's like 2 classes, and then you have all your other illustration courses, and then you pick your liberals around your major courses. So it makes it basically your first 2 semesters are about 18 to 19 credits, which is a pretty heavy load, you know, considering. So went to FIT, and it's a 4-year course. After 2 years, at the end of 2 years, I was already committing and making full finished pieces. And I had some very influential teachers there that really liked my work, and strange thing is, or maybe not that strange to me, and like a group of my friends, we were all like at that same level. We were trying to already be professional, or think that we were professional, and you know, I won't say who it was, but 2 of our professors kind of pulled us to the side and were like, hey, you know, if you guys really go for it, I think you guys can really do something. You know, there's no guarantees, but you know, you probably don't have to stay another 2 years, you know, the way you guys are pushing and you know, the skills you're acquiring. And or actually, what he said, at the rate we were acquiring our skills, it would probably be a good idea to possibly try to get out there. It didn't quite work out, because once I got out there, one of my first jobs was designing tombstones. So it was like literally like talk about a job that can make you nervous is, you know, my mistakes were literally etched in stone. So that job kind of like sidetracked me, because, you know, my own fault. Then, you know, young, pursued other things. I was, you know, really into athletics, really into martial arts, really into working out. And I really wasn't putting in the time art really requires, you know, to develop.
And did you have the idea that you wanted to be a comics artist at that point, or were you just seeing what was out there in the art industry in general? What was the...
You know what? That's a good question, because you know what? Back then, at that time, I was shifting away from comics. I got a push from my teachers to paint more, which is weird since I don't really paint or color at all anymore. I do color some of my stuff, but I was actually thinking of going the fantasy painter route. I was really considering it. At the time, I had favorites like Brahm. He's a fantasy painter. He did a lot of the Dark Sun covers for TSR back then. I guess now it's Wizard owns basically the Dungeons and Dragons stuff. Dark Sun. Did I say Forgotten Realms or Dark? No, Dark Sun. He painted all the Dark Sun covers. And he blew my mind. And then there was another artist that was very popular at the time. Last name Wayland. I forget his first name. And that guy was super popular, and I wanted to go that route. And that was my initial thinking of where I wanted to go. And also, I think if you look at what happened, I mean, we're talking 93 is when I started FIT. So basically by 95, the comics, everyone was talking doomsday about comics. 1995, forget it. That was like literally like the worst year in comics history. So everyone was just like, you know, no way. You know, people were just like, you know, scared, especially, you know, someone, you know, as young as I at the time. I thought, well, there goes that dream or that backup dream, because I've always had a passion for comics, and I thought I could do comics and dabble in painting, which a lot of people do nowadays, but back then not so many people did that, you know. So that's something I did think of. And so comics, the whole industry scared me in general. So I was just thinking, well, maybe just general illustration or like a painting, because that way that can, you know, get me working. But it didn't quite work out that way.
And when did you, was it not until the comics industry kind of saw a resurgence, or when did you finally make the switch over?
You know, I'd have to fast forward and to be really, let's see, I'd have to fast forward to 2009. Mm-hmm. So by 2009, I already was almost like, I think it was like almost a decade since I ever, yeah, 2009, we're talking, and you go back, yeah, about 98 or so, where I actually went into graphic design. And in 98, 99, that was the dot-com boom. Yeah. So I was basically designing. I learned HTML, you know, something, you know, 5-year-olds know nowadays. Yeah. But, you know, in HTML, basic web design, you know, front-end web design. I did design websites, a Flash animation. I don't know if you remember, you know, Flash was a thing.
Oh, yeah. Every website.
Yeah, every website. Oh, you gotta. If you want a cool website, you gotta have a Flash website. So, you know, I learned a lot of the action scripts and all that stuff. So, I was doing putting websites together, you know, pretty well, and that kept me very busy. You know, and that era, it was everyone needed a website, so you couldn't help but fall into the work. You know, and logo designs and people wanted, you know, they needed to have a digital version of their logo because, you know, back at that time, people had a photograph of their logo and all this stuff and didn't have the actual digital version. So, you know, you can make a little extra money doing that. And and I got a gig being a graphic designer at a printing company. So that worked out because the print work or working at a printing company was solid work. And then on weekends and at the evenings, I was designing websites. So it was lucrative, you know, and I did drawings, but it was all stuff that I kept for myself. I did dabble into a comic in 2000 and 2001. And this is probably the first time I'm going to talk about it in an interview because I don't bring it up only because the names are pretty big, but it's not like there's any bad blood or anything. It's just I never really thought to bring it up. So I'm going to have the opportunity to talk about this. But back then, we're talking about this whole dot-com boom. I was actually and this name is more prominent now, but I was Donnie Yen's webmaster. Yeah, so people know that name, and you know, I mean, I knew that name back then because I was a big fan of his. But then also, we're kind of in the same kung fu family. His mother, who teaches in Boston, is my Sifu's Sifu. So going up to Boston to train, I met some people who were close to Donnie. And we talked about, you know, what I did. You know, we just became friends. So they saw that I can draw, and they were interested in doing a comic. And they as we got into the comic work, or we started talking about the comic, I told them I did web design, and they said, "Oh, you know, actually Donnie's looking for a web guy." So then I was actually contacted by him and his sister, and we went back and forth, and that's how I started basically. Maintaining his website. So I was just, back then we would call it a webmaster. I don't even know if anybody uses that term anymore. Remember, you know, I'm blah, blah, blah's webmaster. so that parlayed into starting this comic thing parlayed into that with Donnie, although we're all kind of in the same sphere as far as, you know, the network and the Kung Fu family, so to speak.
What was the comic you worked on with him?
So that comic was two people. They wrote the script, and the comic was called Fu Chen Sung. And the Fu Chen Sung comic was based on an actual kung fu master who he's a Bagua master, which is a, you know, very they literally walk in circles, but walking these circles and in different patterns actually is part of their footwork. Mm-hmm. So this footwork in turn is what creates the style. So the circular footwork style is worked into their fighting art, because in a way, if you attack in a linear movement, they can counterattack in a circular movement, which in turn makes them come around you, or you know, can appear that they're actually behind you when they were just in front of you, and all this other stuff. So my comic was based on that master who was actually a real life master, and I believe that he's actually one of the real life Ten Tigers of Kwangtung, because there was a whole movie about that, and there's these certain real life kung fu masters that were these actual guys. So he's one of them. Mm-hmm. And as far as him being a master, one thing that he did for, I guess as a job or a form of income, is that he would take in travelers, you know, like Western travelers, and he would actually guide them like to the north. So if they landed in Hong Kong and they wanted to go to Beijing, or you know, that long trip, he would go with them just to protect them, so to speak. Mm. So anyway, they developed this really great comic, and that was the first comic I did back then. So they had the script written. I was able to draw and ink the whole first issue. And once I did that, they were working on the second issue. And then I guess I don't know what happened in there. And I think someone moved away and everything slowed down. And it got to the point where I have to say it was me, where I was just like, you know, if I already drew the first issue and I'm waiting for you guys to write the second one, you know, how are we going to keep moving forward? You know, usually the artist is the guy who's the slowest guy, you know, yeah. We usually keep everybody, you know, waiting because, you know, we're doing the heavy lifting. So that kind of fell apart. But how that ties in with Donnie is that Donnie knew about the comic, and they thought, wow, if this comic thing works out, it'll be a good story to take that into film. Mm. So possibly that was probably one of the masters he probably thought about. Actually, I would say that was one of the first masters he thought about portraying before he portrayed Ip Man.
Yeah.
From my knowledge from back then, I mean, again, you know, me and Donnie, and we just, you know, back at that time, we exchanged some emails here and there. I'm not going to pretend like I know the guy like that, but I did work for him. and I know back then the conversation was him playing this character, possibly, you know, after the comic book, you know, settled in. But I think with time, maybe it made better sense to do someone as big as Ip Man. Mm-hmm. Being that he's related to Bruce Lee, so it's kind of like a big story there.
Yeah.
But that was the first comic I did. Never published. I have it on a disc somewhere. I know I have it because I scanned everything in. I even lettered the comic and everything. If I find it, I'll probably post it someday just so people can... Oh, I can laugh at myself. Yeah. You know, I did put in my best effort at the time. And of course, you know, as artists, you know, we're critics today, and then we're even brutal to ourselves from stuff that's like, you know, from 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I'm sure you've progressed a bit in the, nearly 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, what ended up being the second project to get you back into it in 2009, or why yeah, did you decide yeah. to finally yeah. get back into it?
Yeah. So that kind of was basically, so once that kind of fell through, you know, and as far as all the work that was put in and everything, I kind of, at that point, I was almost, you know, over it, you know, like thinking about the economics of it and everything and how, you know, it's, you know, dabbling with web design, you know, I made so much more as far as an income than with comics. So I kind of just, you know, let it fall. Although I was doing some 3D modeling and stuff on my own. I actually learned on my, I was teaching myself 3D modeling. And, well, I can't fully say that because I knew a professor who actually let me jump in his classes every once in a while. So I would pick up a few things. So, I was doing that 3D modeling and everything. And then I just, you know, we didn't do much for almost a decade, you know, I was a graphic designer at a printing company, was very involved with that, actually became art director to eventually become an owner of the company. So that basically was that whole time. So if we just fast forward it to 2009, by 2009, I already sold the company and merged with a bigger company. So I was able to like basically manage like the business that I owned was a division of a bigger company, and I was more like an account manager / art director. And I had no problem with that because, you know, I still had some of the good relationships I had with other businesses, and, you know, the money I made at the time was very nice for a young man without kids. And I won't say coasted, but yeah, no, I coasted. I coasted for a few years. Yeah. I worked my butt off. I really worked my butt off. So at that point, I really was kind of figuring what to do, because as I sold the business, I was almost at the point where I wanted to sell the business and maybe just move on to something else entirely. Mm. Didn't know what exactly, but those were some of the things in the back of my mind. Didn't work out that way because the company seemed like a nice company. I liked the atmosphere. It was a very young team, young management team. While other businesses, I actually had like another company bidding for my business or to buy my business. And this other company, they were, you know, much more established, a lot, you know, they had decades in the business, in the printing industry. And you know, these were older guys that you can tell you were just going to almost fall into a monarchy, you know, like while this other was, you know, it was just younger guys that just wanted like to get stuff done and, you know, be movers and shakers. So join that. Sorry if I'm making this story way too long, but there's a lot of nuance here.
The progression.
yeah. There is no straight lines here. There are no straight lines in my life. It's crazy. So in 2009, a friend of mine looked me up. One that I met when I was studying graphic design. And this friend, he wanted to put an art book together. And since he knew that I was in the printing industry, he wanted some advice, or he wanted to know if we can do it. And he knew that I had a business, so he thought, hey, maybe your company can do it. And I was like, well, I don't do that type of printing, but I do know printers who do that. So, you know, I can probably get you some real pricing. You know, and this is way before, you know, print on demand wasn't even, it was unheard of. You know, this is when, if you wanted something printed, you got to get, you know, at least a minimum of 100 copies just to get started. You know, we're talking everyone, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 copies of books was normal. No such thing as a one-off or on-demand printing at the time. So this friend, actually his name, and a lot of people might recognize him, his name is Kaiserilla. He's on Instagram, and Coran Stone is his name. And he's an animation now. I haven't spoken to him in a while, but I know, you know, he's an animation doing stuff for Warner Brothers, for all the big guys. Mm-hmm. He's doing that now. So at the time, he was living here in Jersey, looking to do this book with some of his friends. And his friends ended up being like a who's who on DeviantArt. Around that time, you know, DeviantArt was king. Like, if you were an artist going anywhere, you were on DeviantArt.
Yeah.
And you were schmoozing with people there, and you were all like, you know, it was good times because, you know, it was a real community back then, I feel. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, you know, not like nowadays where it's all about the likes and all this stuff. Back then, it was, I guess you kind of had your version of likes, but really, if people were just really great artists, they would just rise. Mm-hmm. So I basically kind of art directed it, where I put these guys together. We did a book. It was called Introducing ... So the idea was, let's do this book Introducing, and introduce, you know, basically five artists that are not household names, but that you should know. So I'm gonna try to remember the first few issues, the first few volumes. So volume one was with this guy, Coran Stone, this other artist, Jeff Chamba Cruz. He's a big name now. This other artist, Von Toten was his name, his artist name, but I think his name, Bob Strang is his name, and I think he's doing stuff for Zynga Games or something, or somewhere out in San Francisco, Is it San Francisco? No, he's in Seattle doing, I don't know, whatever good stuff they do in Seattle. Yeah. Chris Copeland, who he does, he's working for, I think he's with either DreamWorks Animation or Warner Brothers Animation right now. And I'm missing someone else. Sorry, but I can't remember that other person. So all those guys graduated to do, you know, such big things. We ended up having 5 volumes. The second volume was a whole bunch of big names. You have Chris's brother, Justin Copeland, who he's actually an animation director now at DreamWorks. DreamWorks Animation. He's an animation director there. His brother's in that book. You have Jeff Wamester, who is like a major character designer at Warner Brothers, I think. So again, the names go on and on, yeah, as far as, you know, the accomplishments. And I did 5 volumes. So I basically every year I would go around, recruit 5 different artists, and put them in these books. Mm. Oh, and another guy is Rock Upchurch. He's a guy who's a co-creator of Rat Queens. Mm-hmm. You know, so Rat Queens is pretty big. Yeah. So I would recruit these artists, put them in this book. You know, they were really, you know, great to work with. And I told them, hey, listen, you know, I'm not a big publisher. This is the best I can do. You know, I'll get the book made. I'll give you, you know, I think the deal was, like, I'll give you 5 copies of the book. And if after my expenses, if I start making money, then, you know, I'm gonna cut you like a percentage of the book. Mm-hmm. And mostly everybody was like, okay, we know you're not gonna make any money, and we'll take our 5 books. Or some of them were like, don't even worry about the books. I'm just happy to do it, because, you know, as far as a publisher goes, I was the publisher. I mean, that's the story. I mean, I was a publisher without even realizing I was being a publisher. You know, I was just putting out this book. I knew printing and graphic design. I knew how to art direct. So I was able to handle this stuff and get the books onto Amazon. You know, so I would put the books on Amazon, and that would help. And their names and people knowing who they were or who they are helped, you know, help with sales. Every endeavor was, I would say, a break even, make a little bit, a little money off of every endeavor. And, you know, if I were to think about the web hosting plus the books, shipping the books to everyone and all that stuff, I mean, that's basically where I was at the end of the year with every one of those projects. So 5 volumes, 5 years, right? Mm-hmm. So by the first year, I was already back in love with drawing and stuff. So all I did was commit to, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to draw something once a week just for myself, something fun, something rad, something that'll keep me excited. And that's how I started. It was just this thing where I would just put stuff out there, share, you know, with friends. You know, I would get some feedback, and then being, I guess, around such heavy hitters, you know, I'd always be very sheepish of showing my stuff, but they always had really great advice, you know, and that would help me come back and just, you know, try to up my game every time. So then now we're going to go to volume 5, which was the last volume put out of the book of introducing. And throughout, like by the time we were like by volume 2 and 3, people were asking, when am I going to go in the book? You know, George, when are you going to go in your book? I mean, it's your own book. Why haven't you put your artwork in it? And at the time, I said, I'm not ready yet. I was like, my book, although I put this book out, I know my art level isn't at the level it should be for me to be in my own book. I had to be realistic that way. You know, I wasn't going to do it just because I can. I think, you know, I had to earn it. If all these other artists had to earn their spot, so would I. So you figure by the 5th volume, I thought I was ready. I come to that because in the 5th volume, there's some drawings in there, and it's the first time I drew Walter Tank, who happens to be one of the main characters of my newly kickstarted book coming out 2020.
Yeah, and it's awesome because that project started as like a webcomic, right?
Right.
When was that? When did that start in that form?
Yeah.
Was it Walter Tank just a one-off character for that book, or did you already have it in mind?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Walter Tank, he was like a series of drawings I did for the introducing book, where for some reason at that time, so we're talking, I think that was like 2013, yeah, about 2013, where I was just dabbling with sketch cards for the first time. There was a few smaller companies that were giving out work. So I was at my headspace was very much in the Victorian era. And I happen to be a big fan of, like, you know, history. I love history. I love, you know, I'm fascinated with World War I, World War II and stuff like that. Like I am, like different events, you know, the different battles and it's just something I've always liked. So I designed these characters, you know, I wasn't thinking steampunk. I was thinking steampunk without really thinking steampunk, because I wasn't trying to fit in the steampunk space. Mm-hmm. It was just something where I truly was looking at Victorian design and what the Victorian look is, and really looking at what the fantasy aspect of it is, you know? So I did these designs. I liked them. And then I just started coming up with a story little by little. So you're looking at, I guess, an incubation period? Yeah. Is that the right? The incubation period from there all the way till 2015, where I thought, you know, I'm going to make a webcomic. That way I can put out the story little by little, you know, build a fan base. If people are interested, maybe I can take it, you know, up further. And just plug away at it however I'd like, and in a way, as I'm plugging away at it and sharing the comic, people can start actually seeing these characters, and I can get feedback and see how it goes, you know. Mm-hmm. So basically, 2015 is when I decided to make a website.
Awesome. And then when did you think that you were ready for it to finally like start the Kickstarter and to become a full book?
Yeah, I think definitely I had the first thoughts of it, I would say, when I did it in 2019. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to do a comic, you know, for the longest time. I've been wanting to do this comic. And I was involved with, like, in just general freelance work, illustration work, and stuff that I like to do, but the result was, you know, this project of mine wasn't really moving forward, and I didn't have a full project, you know, come to bloom yet. Mm-hmm. and quite possibly, you know, being so busy with you know, I built a lot of my business and followers on the sketch card industry, and I've done a lot of sketch cards for, you know, Marvel products, almost everything Upper Deck did, which was Firefly, Marvel, Alien, Aliens, the whole Aliens franchise, Rick and Morty, Adventure Time, it goes on and on. I probably forgot, you know, a few different, and the movie titles, like, you know, they would do sketch cards for the movies, but you can't use the actor likenesses. You have to use comic book versions, which is cool with me. I mean, totally, I'm totally cool with that. So that kept me really busy, and I've gotten some work for small toy design companies. So I was rendering characters and doing that, and I saw that I had a lot of things moving, a lot of artwork going out, but nothing was really mine. Mm-hmm. You know, not my story or anything. So that's when I decided, you know what, I need to lean on this harder. I need to realize that I need to make this happen and to acquire funding, because if I acquire the funding, it'll get done. Because at that point, the funding's there, it'll get done, and there's no excuse why not to do it. So that's why I made that decision to start you know, do a Kickstarter. Let's collect the funds for it. That way I can actually pay for the team. As actually, I'm a Kickstarter. It actually says it right there where this could help me afford the team where this product can get made and I can get it printed.
Yeah. And yeah, it was, I really enjoyed watching the whole Kickstarter campaign because it was really well organized with, like you were doing a lot of promotion, you were sharing a lot of stuff throughout the length of the campaign. How much planning went into the actual, like, marketing of the Kickstarter?
I won it. No. I actually, so to talk about that Kickstarter, I would have to go back to my first Kickstarter, which was my first art book. It wasn't my first art book. It was just my first Kickstarter art book, which is a GV Pop 80s. And the GV Pop 80s is all based on 80s characters. So, 80s, not just 80s characters, but 80s franchises and properties, you know, G.I. Joe, He-Man, Transformers, all of that stuff. So that was my first taste into Kickstarter and the steps. Mm-hmm. So once I did that, I kind of learned, you know, I learned what you need. I can't say I know, you know, what you're supposed to do. I just saw a few. What I did was basically look up all the successful Kickstarters. And by doing that, I kind of saw the blueprint of what needs to be done. Mm. Which is, you know, a promotion, sharing, promoting some more, possibly even having some, a great video helps. And so that one basically gave me all the blueprint for my comic Kickstarter. And I knew that once I had my my video set up, I can share that video and everything else could fall into place. And I can, and at that point, I knew it was up to me just to really share it on my social media as much as I could, you know, I even let people know, hey, just so you know, I'm going to start a Kickstarter. You're going to see a lot of that stuff on my feed. Mm-hmm. So I apologize, but at the same time, I can't apologize because I'm on a mission.
Yeah.
But the one promise I did do and I held up was that no one will get a DM from me about my Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna share the heck out of it. You're gonna see it on my on all my social media, but I'm not gonna DM you about it. That's just the way I feel about it. It's like, you know what? So in other words, on the regular channels, when you go to your phone and your stuff loads, if you see my stuff, great. If not, it's fine. I'm not gonna, you know, hit you up that way. I get that a lot, so maybe that's why I kind of found that as a turnoff. Mm. You know, it's like, you know, just to get somebody who I barely know, hey, check out my Kickstarter, you know, and every once in a while wouldn't be bad, but it's like when you get it often and everyone is doing it, we're all going to become a nuisance. You know, if we're all doing Kickstarters and we're all DMing everyone, we're all going to be a nuisance. So that's why I actually... You know, that's the, if anything, that's one strategy I decided on, you know, no DMs. Mm-hmm. And just regular shares, you know, about two times a day, no more than that.
Yeah, because I think the, like, doing direct messages or, like, sending out email blasts or something, like, if it's targeted or if it's personalized, it can work. But if you're just peppering it out to thousands of people and kind of seeing what works, like I think I agree, most of the ones I get are very, like, annoying and not relevant to me, and it's kind of blatant from the first word.
But yeah,
so there's, like, if you do go that route, I feel like you have to be very careful with it. It's a lot easier to be annoying with it than to be successful.
Yeah, you know, or the biggest move on Facebook is friend request. You accept said friend request, and all of a sudden, bloop, your DM goes off and it's just like, check out my page or check out my Kickstarter. Check out. I was just like, oh, dude. Yeah. You know? Yeah. So that's definitely the one thing. I was like, okay, well, that I won't do. You know, I'll share the crap out of it. and I will be posting about it. But, and other than that, you know, all's fair, you know. An email blast or email list. I mean, I don't have many, you know. I just have a lot of my buyers, you know, people who buy from me typically and stuff like that. So yeah, if I send an email out, it's like once every 2 months, I would say, you know. And then when I was doing the Kickstarter to those people, I possibly sent them in the span of a month maybe four, maybe five emails ever about that. So yeah, definitely something I like to stay away from.
Yeah, definitely. And I imagine, so what do you think the best ways that you've grown your audience have been? Because I know you do a lot of conventions. I imagine that has to help a lot with getting your work in front of new people.
Yeah, conventions help. Conventions help, but I think it's the whole gambit. Running the whole gambit helps.
Mm.
And by running the whole gambit is social media, is actually doing work so that you can post on social media.
Yeah.
and the shows. The conventions are an important component. And it's a tricky and confusing component. Mm. And if you go into conventions thinking that's going to be the answer to everything, and that you're quickly going to see a return on investment, if you think you're going to automatically go to a convention and, you know, Neil Adams is going to pick you up in the air and say, hey, everybody, give this guy all the work.
Yeah.
Or, you know, no. But if you realize that you can form, you know, relationships with, like, real relationships with people that come by your table, real conversations. I believe that's how we met, right? In Boston, I believe, right?
Yep.
Was it Fan Expo?
Yeah, Fan Expo Boston. Stopped by the booth, had a good conversation, and roll from there.
Yeah, and I'm here on your show.
Yeah.
So and little did I know. I mean, really, it's just a matter of really putting yourself out there, you know. And then you have so many tiers to that, like so many levels to that, because you just have anyone that you can talk to at your booth. Then you also have all the other professionals you can meet and talk to. Or network with, you know, professionals that see you and that they get used to seeing you, and that could be another, you know, strange thing or something that you know could blow your mind away. Where, like, you know, you see a certain professional enough times, or a professional meaning a person you might even look up to as far as, you know, the industry, where they're, you know, you become, you know, first name basis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's always wonderful, because then you start, you really get that feeling of, wow, okay, well, I guess I am in the industry, although I may have not done anything that the world knows about, but I you know, my rippling effect is let's just say my art is causing a rippling effect in getting out there. But so I think you do need all those things need to be weighed as far as conventions. And I mean, just convention talk within itself it's a whole entire conversation. Conventions alone, you can talk about that for an hour easily, only because there's so many levels, you know. And you know, first of all, I mean, you've got cosplay. That's this whole entire thing. You know, you've got the actual comics that are there. Then you have indie comics.
Mm.
Then you have the celebrities. Then you have the celebrity / comic artists that are like on a whole nother, you know. So there is a lot going on at conventions. There is. But definitely going to conventions, putting your work out there, really talking to people, and to know that every once in a while, you're gonna connect with someone because someone really connects with your work. It can be a hardened collector. It can be, you know, a 10-year-old walking through the show that just runs to your table and like points at some piece you have on your table or a print you may have and he wants. But those connections, I think, you know, make it all worth it. You know, I believe in the end, you know, a lot of us or most artists, you know, we all would love to go to convention and that's where you get discovered, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it happens that way, but not the way we think it happens. It's not like a reality TV show where, you know, this one person, all of a sudden they're a star. All of a sudden they're going to get the contracts and all that kind of stuff. It actually happens where you actually, you know, do work hard, build relationships, and work these shows to the point where you do get your break. Mm. And it's going to be work. On top of doing all your artwork and all that stuff, there's more work on top of that. With actually navigating that, again, another gambit, another maze of the field itself.
Yeah, and I think because there's so many different facets to the conventions, like you said, it's important to manage your expectations because, like, are you hoping to get discovered and make it big? Are you out there to sell prints? Are you there to drum up, exposure for your new project? Are you there mm-hmm. to network in the industry? Like, I think going in with, why are you there? And instead of just, like, you can't do it all. And having expectations for what you're going to get out of the convention, I feel like, is super important.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, managing those expectations and hoping, you know, and hoping for the best. Hoping for the best. Because in the end of the day, if, you know, you have to look where you're at also in your career. You know, how far you've come, how long you've been working. You know, I think we all, when it comes to sports, when it comes to the art world, when it comes to everything, everyone looks at the star. Everyone looks at that person who made it through and assume or automatically think that's going to be their story too. Because for as many breakaway stars you have, and these people have done amazing things, you have like five to 10 solid people who have had solid careers, mm. who have had happy careers, who have been working in the industry, who have, you know, been able to, you know, provide for their family, who have done some things. And they are professionals and they're just as known as everyone else. I mean, they're not that star, but they're known because they're actually putting in the work, mm-hmm. you know, you put in that work and you're in the industry and that's, you know, where you could hope for. And my whole point about bringing up the star thing is that, you know, it is not all about, you know, how big your project is going to be, you know, if it's going to be the biggest project on the block or, you know, the biggest thing ever, you know, it may not be yet, or it may not be at the moment. You can have a project that might be huge later on, or maybe not. But I think if you want to like not be heartbroken all the time or feel defeated, is, you know, you can't expect everything you do in every project to, you know, light up the world. Mm. You know, but I do believe that if you do have something you're passionate about and you plug away at it, it is going to cause ripples. It is going to have an effect.
Yeah, you can't expect your first comics project to blow up immediately. You got to be willing to put in some years of work and enjoy just the work for that sake, not really expecting to blow up at some point.
Right, right. You know, I mean, you know, you can, I feel that you can, your attitude can be, hey, this is going to blow up. That's fine. You know, I think you should, let's say, give yourself a certain level you're going to function at, or like, you know, I want my art to be at this level, you know, that's fine, you know. But if it doesn't, you know, don't attack yourself for it. You know, don't just think, put your arms up, be like, oh, that's it, the industry doesn't want me. No, because guess what? Just as hard as you worked, a whole bunch of other guys just did the same thing. You know, it's definitely a marathon. It's definitely a marathon. And I guess my point is, it's definitely a marathon. And there are some people who sprinted to the front. They, you know, they got, you know, everything, you know, rather quickly, or everything worked out for them. And that's great. You know, that's awesome. But don't get hung up on their story, man. Just, you know, just focus on you.
Yeah, I think like on the convention point, like how many conventions do you do a year typically?
How many do I do? I think that the number was like 4 or 5 before, but last year it jumped up to like, I think I did about 7. Mm-hmm. So I guess looking at average numbers, I guess typically, you know, looking at six a year. Mm-hmm. And you know, And depending on level of show, I mean, if you're talking big shows, yeah, big shows, definitely a solid 5 or 6 a year. Because I also do a lot of local shows. Mm-hmm. At times I'm invited as a guest. Most local shows I get invited as a guest. You know, I guess around my area, I'm somewhat known here in Jersey, so that works out well. I mean, I'm right next to New York, so it's not like I'm going to be easily recognized in New York, but, you know, I do okay over there, too.
Yeah, I think those smaller conventions have value, too. Like you said, the importance of having, like, good conversations, and those kind of give you more opportunities for those.
Yeah. If it's a small convention put together by the right people, it works out also, because I have attended some small conventions where, for a fact, I know they did not know how to do a comic book convention. All they did was try to have one guest or two guests, and then just invite a whole bunch of somewhat. It almost looked like something. You know, it looked almost like a flea market. You know, all kinds of vendors that are willing to sell almost anything. And then they had like almost no marketing, and they didn't market to the right people, you know. And you get people that wander into the show asking, what kind of show is this? And you're like, oh my God. You know, if I had to give anybody some advice, if you're at a show, you're at a convention and it's slow and people are walking around asking you questions that are kind of like leaving your mouth open, or you know, like, you know, very basic questions, the promoter didn't do his job. that place was not promoted properly, and it may not even be considered a convention, because at that point, you know, you basically went to a convention / flea market.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, what conventions do you have coming up?
I just posted something today. I'm gonna get the name right, because it's the first time I'm going to this convention, and PowCon, PowComicCon in Brooklyn. And talking about conventions, these guys actually, you know, they have, you know, Larry Hama. I mean, if you're a G.I. Joe fan, you know who Larry Hama is. They actually have some wrestlers there. They've got some Power Rangers, you know, 100% marketed to comic people. You know, I mean, that's the typical comics crowd. They've got some other celebrities there. So they're they know what they're doing, and it's in Brooklyn. I mean, I've never attended a Brooklyn event that wasn't you know, well attended, and the people weren't savvy about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And yeah, what and other? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, so talking about, so that's did I give you a date? If I didn't give you a date. The 26th, I think that is. Mm-hmm. It's a 2-day show. Hold on, that's the 25th and the 26th.
Yeah.
That's so basically that's my first show of 2020. Then after that, I'm doing a C2E2. That's in mm-hmm. Chicago. Then after that is Emerald City Comic Con. That's in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as I know. Or yeah, that's as far as I'll go. I mean there are other shows I want to attend, but they're too far out to even, you know, think about, because you know, one thing's always important to me is if I'm on a project and if I have a deadline, then you know, I'll have to, you know, not go to a show because I need to finish my work.
Yeah.
So that's number one, and luckily I haven't had any of those issues yet. I've been able to manage my work and the conventions. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, speaking of thinking far out, what are your future plans for your art and for World of M?
Yeah, the World of M definitely issue number 2. Definitely in 2020 we'll get issue number 2. Mm-hmm. When exactly? I'm not sure. I'm thinking, second quarter, the end of second quarter. So that's April, May, June, right? Mm-hmm. So around then, because the project I do want to do next is my follow-up art book to a GV Pop 80s, will be GV Pop 80s Volume 2.
Yeah.
Where I can do more, I'm gonna have more 80s art in there, and that'll be a Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to do that one, because I'm gonna try to get into some other 80s stuff that I've always liked but never had a chance of drawing. You know, a Speed Racer, Silverhawks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of other, there's so much 80s stuff, but like there are things that I do stick to, and I think people would want to see me delve into other properties as a fan. So I'm looking forward to working on that, because I do have a bunch of fan art I've already done, commissions I've already done that I can actually put into this book. Mm-hmm. But I plan to do some newer art also as I'm doing the campaign, which I like showing people, you know, new art as I do the campaign. That way they know that I'm actually really believe in the project, you know, and I really do believe it's going to be funded. So you work and do art for the book as I'm campaigning for the funds. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a great strategy of like using work, then like letting your work build up until it's ready to create a more like packageable product, or, mm-hmm. I think that's a great model to make, package things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think everything takes an initial investment. So even if, you know, I've always liked and seen that Kickstarter comics that do well or get funded, for the most part, always have a few pages already done. Mm-hmm. So as far as initial investment, that means that the creator, you know, it could be the writer, I'm in a, you know, fun position or my position, I'm in a good position because I'm the artist, but I do write, but I'm not the writer. Mm-hmm. So as an artist, I can contact the writer and say, hey, listen, you know, let's work on some few pages, let's have some pages done, and you know, I'll do them. Most writers will be like, heck yeah, because, you know, we know, you know, if you know a writer and you're working as a team, they respect the fact that the illustrator does do all the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
I think my son just walked in the room. I don't know if he saw him.
Yeah.
you know, with respect, everyone knows the illustrator is doing all the heavy lifting. I'm not saying that they're the most important thing in the book or the comic. I'm just saying that, hey, listen, if one thing is clear and one thing we don't have to argue about is who's doing the heavy lifting.
it's definitely the most time consuming.
Biggest investment. You're talking hours and hours. So I'm in that position where that investment I can put in, and then if I get a colorist to do the colors, I can pay him, letterer to do what he does, and then I can get those pages done, and really that's my initial investment to get this Kickstarter going.
Awesome.
And I've noticed that most comics that do well always have a few pages done. If I had to give someone advice, I think that's the best model. You might lose a few hundred bucks, but guess what? I mean, if you don't do that, I mean, what are you going to show, sketches and promise?
Yeah.
Say, hey, you know, or just have the script. You know, it's tough. Or just show a blank script with no art. Pretty tough sale, man. Pretty tough sale.
Yeah, you need to let people know what you're trying to produce, and I think doing it like doing it as a webcomic first, or like with your 80s book, just having commissions and prints and other stuff where you're not just like doing this work and hoping that it does well on Kickstarter. Like, you're doing it for something else, and then once you have enough of it, you can make a Kickstarter out of it.
Yep. That's definitely the way.
Awesome. Well, yeah, this has been great, George. Do you have one final piece of advice for someone just starting out?
Oh, wow. One final piece of advice. So much pressure, man.
Right. Yeah, consolidated all down into one thing.
One piece of advice. Thinking about everything I said, all the stories I threw at you, and I apologize because I always said, and I've always said on my post, hey, come to my table because I got plenty to talk about. So I think I proved it here that I'm always, I could definitely run my mouth, that's for sure. So what I've been running my mouth about, I think in the end, is that your story doesn't have to be a straight line, and it may not be a straight line. And you may have to take some turns. You may have to actually do some bargaining, inner bargaining, outer bargaining, whatever you have to do to reach your goals. But one thing has to be clear is that you do have to have a goal set for it. Because, you know, I really didn't start accomplishing anything with my art until I started laying goals down. Which one of my first goals was, hey, I just want to do one drawing a week. Then all of a sudden it was like, okay, I want to do a bigger drawing a week. Then the next goal was like, hey, you know, I want to do like an elaborate piece. And, you know, and show that to people and see how people think of a big elaborate piece. And that's what actually helped me move forward. With the work, and those small goals actually forced my skills to raise. So as I kept trying to do this work, my skills had increased to meet that work, that goal, as well as actually looking for the information. So in turn, it doesn't have to be a straight line, but you do have to make goals. And keep those goals relative, right? Keep them relative to where you're at. You know, from my beginning goal, which was small pieces, you know, small drawing here and there, and eventually to bigger pieces. I remember the first year I started getting work was I wanted to have at least one professional illustration job, at least something that was where I have to invoice and they have to pay the invoice, you know. And the year I decided that, it happened. You know, the one year where I said, you know, I want to work in this. I want to try out these sketch cards. I want to work in that industry. You know, I want to try it out. and I found out about it and joined some Facebook groups and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, one morning somebody posted, hey, they're looking for artists for this type of fantasy set or something. Actually, that company's not even around anymore. They were looking for someone to draw some fantasy pieces. I got the email, sent some samples in, and that was one of the first sketch card jobs I got. And it's all a result of making those small goals, keeping them reasonable, and working to meet that goal.
Yeah, and I think even the stories about, like, you know, thinking about going into fantasy painting and doing printing, it all kind of helps tell that story where, like, yeah, your end goal is probably going to change a ton of times, and you know, definitely not moving in a straight line, but you got to set some kind of goal down, some kind of path, otherwise you're just stagnating, and, you know, getting any progress will lead you to the next thing, whether that's a completely different thing, or, you know, any goal setting and progress is gonna move you forward in some way.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, this has been great. Where should people go to check out World of M, check out your other work, and follow you?
Actually, this is a perfect opportunity, because I believe the digital copies went out today. Did you get your digital copy yet?
I did, yes. We can talk on that for a minute, because I read it about an hour ago.
Oh yeah, cool.
It's awesome. Love the style. The world is really, it's piqued my interest that I'm ready for issue two.
Oh, awesome. It's some spoilers there, so watch out.
Yeah.
All right, cool. So number one is, so the World of M has its own website, so you could actually read the first 9 pages online, which is theworldofm.net. So if you go to theworldofm.net, you can read the first 9 pages free. So what a better lead in than that, you know? So you can get that there. Right now, I'm starting to open for pre-orders of the actual comic, because everything is sent at the printers. Everything's approved. Next week sometime, I should get my first shipment of comics. So literally right now, I'm about to open for pre-order. So by the time I guess this goes online or this podcast is out there, I'll be, you know, open for orders. And I'll still be in pre-order stage, because I won't have anything really in hand yet. And people can find me at George Vega Art, almost on any social media platform, on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. If you look up George Vega Art, you'll be able to find me. And anyone can, you know, feel free to DM me about the comic. Feel free to DM me about anything. A beginning artist, I have no problem offering advice. I get emails all the time, you know, emails or DMs all the time about, you know, about questions about the industry, questions about art, developing their art. You know, I can't be a tutor to everyone, but if I can help you out and by answering a question or pointing you in the right direction, you know, I'm more than happy to do that, because, you know, I struggled a lot, and there were people who did not have to give me any of their time, and they did. And I'm always grateful to that, and I owe that to the industry. I owe that to other people, that if anybody wants some information or needs some help, to try to at least point them in the right direction or give them some good advice. I guess what's called paying it forward. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely down for paying it forward. They can reach me online. I'm all about the World of M right now. The comic is actually done. It's freshly out there. Any other art projects, let's see what happens.
Yeah. And yeah, just don't lead with your Kickstarter link.
yeah. Like, oh, by the way, check out my Kickstarter. Hey, can I help you out with?
Hey, you said you'd be up for giving me advice, so here's my Kickstarter.
Yeah. Not really the best way to, you know what? I will delete that DM. I will delete it.
But yeah, I really appreciate you paying it forward here and coming on and giving me some of your time. This has been awesome.
Oh, thank you.
There you have it, guys. My talk with George Vega. Yeah, I really enjoyed this talk, and I think one thing that I think was very clear is, you know, he kind of talked about how your journey may be very different than other people's, and it may be a, you know, take you down a lot of different paths and take you on a strange route, and that's okay, and that's your journey. And I think he talked about the importance of having a goal throughout that, and sometimes that goal might change or be revised, or kind of, you know, as you weave through this journey of yours. And yeah, I think that's a great message for anyone starting or in the middle of their entrepreneur journey, is, you know, yours is going to be different, and the path to your whatever your goal is going to be wildly different than anyone else's. So you know, kind of follow where things take you, and trust that your journey's headed in the right direction, and set some awesome goals for yourself. And yeah, I hope this episode has helped you get some advice for your entrepreneur journey. I would definitely follow George at George Vega Art on all social medias, at theworldofm.net for the World of M comic, which is, I definitely recommend checking out, fantastic comic. And I will include links to all of this in the show notes at underthecapes.com/episode64. And until next time, I hope you guys got a lot out of this. I hope you learned something. If you did, please reach out and let me know. And yeah, get back to making or working on whatever your project is this week. Good luck, and thanks, guys. Thanks so much for listening to the Entrepreneur Podcast by Under the Capes. I hope this episode has helped motivate you to either start or grow your geek brand. If you liked the episode, I would love if you could give us a rating and a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you happen to be listening from. And feel free to connect with us on social media, on Twitter at Under the Capes, on Facebook at Under the Capes, and on Instagram at Under the Capes Cosplay. Thanks so much, and have a great day.